Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is E.L. Doctorow, whose latest novel is Homer and Langley. Earlier novels include The March, Ragtime, Billy Bathgate, recently also a collection of essays titled Creationists, former senior editor at New American Library, editor-in-chief at Dial Press, and considered one of America's finest writers. E.L. Doctorow, this new novel, Homer and Langley, deals with brothers, the Collier brothers, who were real people. Before we go into how you discovered them, in real life, their birth and death dates were around 1885 to 1947, but the Collier brothers of Homer and Langley are about 10 or 15 years younger, and they live well into the 70s.
Yeah, I extended their lives. But you see, their folklore, their myth, and so no matter what a particular author does with the time frame, they're immortal. They keep going.
Well, how did you discover the Collier brothers?
Well, when I was a boy, it was a big story in the paper when they died. The police had to hack into the house because it was so filled with stuff. They found one body, but not the other. It turned out that Homer was completely dependent on Langley. Langley was a bit paranoid at the end of his life and had constructed from these bales of newspapers and various other things traps and snares for presumed interlopers and prowlers. There were rumors that they were very wealthy, and Langley assumed that they would be robbed. What happened, of course, is he got caught in one of his own traps and buried under tons of stuff, and they discovered his body a couple of weeks after they discovered Homer's body, and they realized that Homer had died of starvation. Langley was his sole support.
The real Homer was blind as well as...
The real Homer was blind, but didn't become sightless as early as I decided he would become. And that came of the first line of the book, which is, I'm Homer the blind brother. That line set up everything for me. It would be a memoir of sorts. He would be the narrator. And he would tell their story.
Well, once you put that together and said that sentence, of course, Homer comes up. Was there any attempt to link this Homer with that Homer in terms of creating the Odyssey of his life?
Not by me, but leave it to the reader to do that.
When you're working on this, then, that brings up a question. What themes are conscious, or are you just pretty much telling the story and not worrying about themes at all?
For me, writing is improvisatory, and you start not knowing really where you're going, and you write to find out what you're writing, and the book begins to tell you what to do and give you direction. You need sentences that generate other sentences, basically. And after a while, you understand what you're doing, and you have to make good on the premises that you've set up for the book. I invented this background for Homer and Langley, and it turned out that what interested me more than anything, more than their fact that they were aggregators, by the way, I don't like the phrase pack rats. What interested me about the story when this news first broke, thousands of people collected around the house to watch the cops throw stuff out, and they were instant folklore. But to me, the mystery of them wasn't the fact that they were these eccentrics, that they had opted out, that they had come from a well-to-do family. They were pretty well-educated, cultivated, and they made this choice. They closed the door, pulled the shutters tight, and retreat. It was, in my mind, equivalent in momentousness to an act of emigration. They were leaving this country and making another country inside that house. So I viewed the writing of the book as an act of breaking and entering, to see what was going on there, and wanting to get into their minds and figure them out. And so what you do, of course, you get into your own mind, and that happens.
Obviously, for me at least, when I began reading it, I thought of Grey Gardens, but it's my understanding that that was never really on your mind at all.
No, I've since heard about Grey Gardens. I didn't see that movie. I knew about those women, but it seems to me that's clinical material. I wasn't interested in the clinical factual issues of their mental illness in Homer and Langley, that they were considered great eccentrics in their day, but subsequently they're defined psychiatrically as obsessive-compulsive disorder victims in their hoarding.
When you go into that world and you begin to explore, obviously, the differences between what really happened and the Homer and Langley of E.L. Doctorow move in different directions. So you create the reason for Langley's strange behavior in what happens during World War I, whereas, in fact, we really don't know. Is that correct?
Well, once people achieve this kind of folklore status, there are two existences for the Colliers. There's the physical, factual, historic existence, and there's the mythic existence. So I ignored one and chose the other to interpret, that you don't do research when you're dealing with myth. You interpret the myth. For instance, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides all had a shot at the house of Atreus. I just felt that I would try to understand this mythic existence of theirs. The same kind of double kind of life that Abraham Lincoln has in our minds. There was the actual Lincoln and there's the mythic Lincoln. Of course, these guys are not as exalted as that, but it's the same kind of situation.
There's a certain point, of course, where you really go off, which is when you have them live 30 extra years.
Well, I needed every one of those years to tell this story. See, Langley, who's come out of World War I quite bitter, kind of grim, verging on very ironic, dry, acerb kind of personality. Langley begins to collect newspapers. In those days, New York City had 7 or 9 dailies and a lot of smaller papers. He collects them all, and it turns out his idea is, by researching these newspapers over the years, learning what seminal human behavior is, and on the base of that data, creating his own newspaper that he expects to be the final newspaper, that no one will ever have to read another one. It's the eternally current, one edition only, Collier's newspaper. It will cover every conceivable human act and will already be in there. So it's kind of a prophetic newspaper.
The voice of the book is Homer, and he's blind. I would think that that would present special problems for you as a writer.
It certainly is, a narrator, yes, in his voice. And it was an interesting challenge. I didn't find it as difficult as I thought it would be, and it turned out to give me, oddly enough, certain insights from his point of view that I might not have had otherwise if he was a sighted person. But he's generally forbearing. He understands his brother. He sympathizes with his brother. And he's capable of quite a bit of humor, dry humor of his own. And he goes along with Langley's excesses. And there are certain images that come to mind that I really like as I think about this book. For instance, when they sort of inherit a bicycle wheel for two and ride around the neighborhood with Langley in the front, of course, and Homer in the back. There's some factual basis for some of the things they do. For instance, Langley did collect pieces of a Model T Ford and bring them into the house. I don't know if he actually reconstructed the entire Ford, but I have him doing that in the dining room. He brings the Model T. Not really knowing why he's done this or what its purpose is, he has this feeling that something is of value and will be useful, but he doesn't quite know in what way. So, of course, the car standing in the dining room begins to collect cobwebs, and they threw other things on top of it. I enjoyed that scene.
It seemed almost that because we're not actually seeing what's going on, in essence, we're not visualizing the decrepitness of it all, because Homer doesn't see the decrepitness, and it's almost like we're seeing the ghost of what's really there.
That's a good point. One of the issues as I was writing was not to overdo the accumulation of things. So when it came up in the action, for instance, when the fire department comes in because there's a fire in the little backyard and the hose begins to flip around as the water comes through it, that gives me an opportunity to describe some of the things in the rooms. When there's a blackout and they're leading the hippies down through the house, I can do that, but I always try to have a reason for mentioning these things that have been collected.
You also have Homer go out into the world, and whether he actually went out or not is immaterial, but he goes out into the world, and actually Langley does as well. And yet, I guess because he's blind, he never really leaves the house, even when he goes out.
Well, he doesn't go that far. As he's going blind as a boy, he makes a point of mapping out the neighborhood by the number of steps it takes to get to the end of the block. And he sort of measures out a 10 or 20 block area. And he also gets to know Central Park pretty well because they're living across the street from the park. It's true they do get up, but not very far.
The original mansion is past the park, right?
The actual mansion was on 128th Street and Fifth Avenue. In fact, one of the possible reasons I got to thinking about this as a possible book is that there was an article in the New York Times about 6 or 7 years ago. They had no heirs, and this house was such a mess and such a wreck that the city tore it down and made a little park there on the corner of 128th Street and Fifth Avenue. That was in, like, 1948 or 49. A few years ago, the people in the neighborhood decided that they didn't like the name of that park. It was called the Collier Brothers Park. There's a brass plaque up there, and it's Collier Brothers Park. And they wanted to change. It's a lovely little park, the footprint of a brownstone. Incidentally, the neighborhood is quite elegant with these beautiful row houses. They still felt the neighborhood was being shamed or defamed. So I figured, gee, 50 years after their death, they're still disturbing people. That's interesting. That's myth. For some reason along the course of writing the book, I didn't quite know why, but I needed to have them facing Central Park. So I moved their house down several blocks in the late high 90s, say.
Okay, in my brain, they were in the Frick Museum, but what do I know?
No, that was a little further down.
Yeah.
The actual park extends to 110th Street.
By extending their lives, you were able to deal with the change of consciousness. And one of the major changes that I see is that in real life, of course, these people were gone right after the war. But now, by living through the 60s, they almost get a second life and become, in a sense, heroes to hippies. They become hippies. There's this weird circle that comes back, and they're suddenly in vogue again.
Well, what happens in the book is that they wander out into the park when there's an anti-war rally. And because they're so shabbily dressed and they haven't cut their hair, and they're recognized as sort of proto-hippies by some of these hippies in the park who come back and crash. Their house becomes a pad. And they do very well, and it's a period of great elation for them with all these energetic young people around. And at one point, they're very engrossed by the diction of the 1960s. And one of the characters sings a song that begins, "Good Morning, Teaspoon." Homer and Langley are each interpreting what that could possibly mean, and neither of them gets it. It's a song by Richard Farina. "Good Morning, Teaspoon, Give Me Back My Brain."
Do you admire the Colliers?
My Colliers, yeah. I have great affection for them, yeah. They're very interesting, yeah.
I didn't notice any, but do you have any cameos from characters from your other books in this one?
No.
Not at all? You chose not to?
It's not a matter of choice. This book and this situation and its meanings and what it's about have really nothing to do with any of the other books.
It seems that what you're writing is almost like somebody in a closed environment peering out and seeing a 50-year history of America.
Yeah, well, at a certain point, oddly enough, I began to think of this as a road novel, as these two guys walking along in their lifelong conversation, back and forth, having adventures, but of course they don't move. They're more or less housebound. And so I think the road is coming through them. See, the world really doesn't let them alone. Kids throw rocks at the house, and they have this enormous titanic battle with the utilities, with the phone company and the electric company, and then finally the city turns their water off. And it's a sense of that people who do this are a great insult to the community around them somehow. The idea of opting out, of course, is historic in the United States. I mean, you could say that, for instance, the Beats were classic opter-outers. So were the hippies. So was Greta Garbo. But this has happened all through our history. For instance, in Westchester County, north of New York, in the 1920s, there was someone known as the Leather Man. He was this gigantic fellow, old man, and he had these plates of leather all over him, dressed like an old Viking, the pointed hat and a lot of pieces of fur on his shoulder, and he had a big staff. And he lived in the woods. He wouldn't talk to anyone. People left him food. He's very gentle. He had just decided to live that way, not in civilization. So in a sense, the Colliers withdrew, and the country came after them. The country followed them in there.
I know that a lot of this bubbles up from the unconscious, but, you know, this book was written, I guess, last year and the year before, the past couple of years.
I actually started it when the previous administration was in power.
How much of where we are today is sitting there in the back of your mind? I mean, is it a coincidence that you write a book about Sherman's march through the South during the height of the Iraq War, for instance? Or is that just...
Well, these are never conscious decisions, yeah. But I think, like most people who spend their lives writing fiction, you do think differently from most people. You're not an autonomous spirit. You're in the world, but you translate it in some ways metaphorically that allows people or that leads people to think you know exactly what you're doing at any given time. But, of course, there was this war going on, and war was on my mind. It was on everyone's mind. With General Sherman, I had thought of that book maybe 20 years before when I read a topical history of Sherman's march. It was quite unique for the Civil War. As murderous as the war was, this was almost a separate thing. And I remember thinking of it as possibly the armature for a novel. But I didn't do anything about it for 20 years. But one day, probably in about 2003 or 4, it became the only book I could write.
The last mention in Homer and Langley of any actual event is People's Temple, 1978. You end it shortly thereafter. We don't know how much further. But I keep thinking of where America derailed and how America derailed to get us to George W. Bush. You know, I just wonder, in your book and in other books, it seems like now that we're past Bush, but we don't know where we are today, I wonder if it's time to start reflecting back and figuring out how we got from point A to point B. And on some unconscious level, maybe by writing this particular book, which spans a broader period than other books, you're doing that as well.
Well, it's possible. When you're writing the book, you're staying in it. You have to. You don't think outside. You have to respect the integrity of the process. And you don't become programmatic. And you don't think that way. You live in the sentences. You're there with these people. Right now, I'm one of those authors who believe that an author has no more credibility as interpreter of a book than any reader has. In fact, the book is not completed till the reader reads it. The reader's mind sort of flows through the lines of the book. It's like an electric circuit. And some people have said to me, this is about entropy, isn't it? And, well, yeah, that's a possible way to think about it. That there's some sense of something coming to an end about us in this book. But I don't testify to these things. I don't embrace any. In fact, I tend to agree with any interpretation as long as it's reasonable.
Two recent interviews I had, one was with Nicholson Baker and one was with Margaret Atwood, and Baker said he loves to hear authors and what they have to say because for him it illuminates. Margaret Atwood's position, on the other hand, is, if I didn't write it, it's not part of my world, you figure out what you want to do with it. And I would tend to think that that is how you look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the work is done, and it's there. The late critic Richard Poirier said, fiction is by its nature imponderable, that it's really very mysterious. And if a book is any good, it shimmers with ambiguity. The word imponderable is very suggestive to me. And then, of course, we will remember the intentional fallacy that writers start out thinking they're doing something, intending to do something, and it doesn't turn out to be that at all. I was quite surprised, for instance, when I delivered the manuscript many years ago of Ragtime, and my editor then said to me, you know, you tend to write about the past. I said, oh, I didn't realize that. You're right. A couple of books are about the past. People always have different ways of looking at it. Someone says, well, you write historical novels. I disagree with that, but it's all right. And then they'll say, and also you have a political sensibility. Look at the Book of Daniel. Okay. And then someone else will say, and you do use the genres. I mean, Billy Bathgate, gangster, and your first novel, Welcome to Hard Times, took place in the West. And you do use genres. You bounce off. Oh, yeah, that's true. And also you said a lot of books in New York City, so you're a New York writer. Yeah. And you have postmodern techniques in your work. Yes, I do. So I'm an historical, political genres, New York genres, postmodernist.
During the period from 1959 until, I guess, 69, a 10-year period, you were an editor, a book editor. Do you think that impacted you in a specific way as a writer?
I was told not to go into publishing when I was starting out as a writer. I began as a reader for a film company. I would read a book a day and write a synopsis of it and then deliver yourself of an opinion as to whether it would make a movie or not. From that, I went into publishing because I did not consider myself a careerist as an editor. They kept giving me better and better jobs because I really didn't want them. And all that time, but it was very useful. First of all, reading so many books as a reader for a film company, I had great encouragement because I saw how many bad books were being published. That was very encouraging to me. And then when I was working with other writers as an editor, I think on the basis of that, I was able to look at my own work objectively and dispassionately in the way I would look at someone else's work. You know, this chapter doesn't belong here. This line is stupid. Just have that same judicious disinterest. So publishing was very valuable for me. And in addition to being exciting and I finally left it when I was writing the Book of Daniel. I realized I couldn't. By that time, they'd made me the publisher as well as the editor-in-chief. And this book either was going to get done. So I quit my job, best wage I'd ever had. I fortunately was invited to do a visiting writer gig at the University of California at Irvine. And that's where I finished the Book of Daniel. And that was the end of my publishing career.
Well, when you moved on to books like Ragtime, The March, other books that are very complex in their form, do you think your work as an editor let you step back and make sure that it all worked? Because Ragtime has so many different threads, and The March as well have so many different threads, and they have to come together just right.
Well, press on, and things occur to you, and you make discoveries. You don't feel possessive about what you write. You make the discoveries. You're the instant reader of every line you write. You do have some sense of the overall form of the thing, and characters emerge whole. That you don't have to assemble them. They're there. You speak of threads, but there's no sense of having any aesthetic manifesto when you're doing it. I mean, some of these books are very clear linear narratives. Others are more collagist in the way they're constructed. And it's always the book that tells you what it has to be. And you just follow its dictates and try to realize it and make it work, basically.
Did you use virtually all the material you wrote for Homer and Langley, or were there a lot of dead ends at all?
No, this was pretty straightforward. But that's an interesting question. You know, all fiction is an assemblage of scene and montage. And what I was interested here in this book, unlike, say, The March, which is very scenic, very in the sense of drama, what I was interested here is the sense of montage, of someone's memory would just flow along, and then something would rise from that river and become an event or scene. But it was the sense of the flow of this fellow's memory that I wanted to dominate the kind of text it is.
In other words, scattered throughout there are, I don't want to call them flashbacks. He talks about his past, but it's always within the context of the present. So it doesn't feel like a flashback in the same way.
No, I wanted to just have this sort of flow of memory with particular events coming up for more detail in terms of justifiable impact on their lives.
E.L. Doctorow, the previous book was called Creationist and contained essays on people like the Marx Brothers, Melville, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Einstein. The essays published over a long period of time, was that always intended to be some kind of project that just came along in steps?
No. Those were all responses to invitations of one sort or another, to write an introduction to something of Scott Fitzgerald's or Sinclair Lewis. The piece about Einstein came of an invitation to speak at the Aspen Institute. The theme of that weekend was Einstein's life, and they brought in a lot of scientists, and they brought in me, which is pretty scary. I mean, I hadn't been in such an exalted company since I was a student at the Bronx High School of Science. So I talked about the experience of creativity for scientists, and its parallel for literary creativity. Everything in there I was invited to do, because I don't really naturally gravitate to nonfiction, to criticism. But once we realized, my editor and I, that there was enough material for a book, she said, well, let's do it. And I put them together and sewed them together with an introduction and called it Creationists as a kind of a, well, you know why. I mean, these are the creationists, Einstein and Mark Twain and the people who wrote Genesis.
E.L. Doctorow, obviously over the last few years we've had to deal with political issues, and you have gotten involved writing for The Nation, putting your voice out there. How easy was it or hard was it for you to take on a somewhat different role, a role beyond just being a novelist?
Well, writing politics is, to me, as risky because you use the current diction. Political diction, there's no way to get around it. You say things like campaign finance, finance reform, and every time you say a phrase like that, you wince. But every once in a while, something becomes necessary. Now, if someone has invited me to deliver a commencement speech, I take that very seriously, and inevitably it becomes, wake up, or these people are going to make your history for you. And last time I did that, the people were booing. This was at Hofstra University, and I was talking about the lies of President Bush, why we were going to war. In those days, he was claiming weapons of mass destruction, and everybody in the street knew it was a lie. But this school, Hofstra, happened to be in a very Republican county. And so the parents were booing me, and it was a great day. The best part of it was that the commencement was on a football field where the Jets used to practice. So I was on the 35-yard line giving my talk. But, you know, a friend of mine once said, if someone gives you a forum, take it. And so those times that I have done political speech, that too is a matter of invitation. Like the last one I did was a talk at the Library of Congress before the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Philosophical Society about the same issue, the deterioration, the subversion, if you will, of the Constitution and the sense of the whole country could just falling apart.
At what point do you think maybe we're there now where we should stop waiting for Obama and hoping for Obama and begin finally saying, you know, we got to get out there?
Well, the fact is I'm a kind of a Franklin Roosevelt liberal, one of those detestable liberals, and I'm still hopeful that he's smarter than I am. I'm pretty sure he is, and that he knows what he's doing, and it's all going to work out. What he's dealing with is not only economic disarray, a war that he was handed, ecological disaster impending, but he's dealing with a country that has lost its sense of identity. However illusionary we all have been to discover that we are torturers, to discover that our phones and emails are being illegally tapped into, it's unsettling, and there's a kind of hysteria on the land that the sort of misdirected populism and racism and nativism and these shrill voices on the radio, and we have one of the major parties seems to be run by people who are not patriots anymore. They want the country to fail so that their party will succeed. They're not patriots, they're partyists. So this sense of an identity, enormous identity crisis is what my feeling is, and that's what he's dealing with, apart from everything else.
As you were talking, I was thinking, you know, going back over your books, you know, the one thing that Ragtime was, the book Ragtime, and whatever your feelings about either the movie or the musical, it was about a sense of identity of America. That feeling, that solidness, felt to me like in December 2000, it just vanished.
Yeah, one of the underlying themes of that book, I think, is assimilation. Three families, there's a kind of an implosion, and they become one family. Actually, the musical, I didn't like the movie at all. I thought it was a disaster. But the musical version is, tonally it's quite different from the book. The book keeps its distance from the characters. It's told as an historical chronicle. You can't do that when people go around singing their feelings on stage. So it's kind of an inversion of the tonal inversion of, but the music is lovely and the lyrics are very astute, and Terrence McNally did a kind of Brechtian thing to make it all work in 3 hours. So I think of it now, I mean, these people thought they were writing a musical. What they were writing was an American opera, I think. And now there was a production at the Kennedy Center in Washington. They're bringing that to New York, reviving it on Broadway this fall.
E.L. Doctorow, now that you've written Homer and Langley, have you begun thinking about your next project?
No, it usually takes me 6 months to a year to recover from a book and it's kind of like a hangover. And you're still living with these guys and thinking about them. And it takes a while for the whole world to fade from your mind so that you can look around.
Can you ever go back and look at your old books, or are they just on the shelf and they're gone?
Generally, I feel a kind of remote relationship. Occasionally, a new edition comes in, I'll crack it open, look at a page, and I say, oh, did I write that? That's pretty good. Or I'll find a line that makes me wince and quickly close the book. So it's...
When going back to the Book of Daniel, obviously since then there's been a lot of historical material that was not available to you at that point. And this is separate from any of your other works. Do you ever go back to think about it and think about what kind of book you would have written today, or is the E.L. Doctorow who wrote that, knowing what he knew then, so far in the past that you wouldn't even give that another thought?
Well, I didn't know anything then. I didn't know those people. I did read some of the trial transcripts. And the reason I was able to write that book is the problem was being intimate with what was happening, but really not understanding it at all. And my solution to get to that point was to write from the point of view of a child, Daniel. It would Daniel write the book so he could be living through this and not have any control over it and not really understanding it. In terms of the revelations of the about the Rosenbergs, Julius Rosenberg spying, and he was a spy, this is all anticipated in the book, oddly enough. Everything that's happened with the Venona data and so on is all there in the book, which to me is gratifying. People who haven't read that book think it's just a sort of a defense, a legal defense of two innocent people. But it's not that at all. It's really about 30 years of life in my country, as told from the point of view of dissent of one kind or another. The old left and then the new left.
You were speaking before about how a novel comes together, and it strikes me in talking to a lot of writers that underneath it all, it's not about pushing your ideas out. It's not about necessarily creating characters or stories, but it's more, and this is more, I think, more true of fiction than nonfiction. It's really about exploring things that are in your head and will never, ever leave you alone until you try to figure them out.
Yeah, there's a certain obsessive quality to this life, absolutely. And you learn a lot about yourself, and you learn how to treat yourself as a writer. All the little tricks of self-destruction that you inflict on yourself to sabotage what you're doing, the ways you have to be careful that when you've done something that doesn't work, it's always a small sign that you get. It's never loud, and you have to pay attention to it. Hemingway was a great psychologist of writing. He understood the ways he had very simple ideas. For instance, always stop writing when you know what's coming next. He said that. And I've discovered that it's very important not to be terribly comfortable when you're writing. Maybe having a chair that wobbles or light that's not quite right. I've seen authors, writers who just furnish their studies just brilliantly, just something out of a movie, and they're stone cold dead.
When you're looking at Homer and Langley after the fact, is there anything you could point to and say, I learned this about me? I learned this about E.L. Doctorow?
Well, that's a very personal question. All I will say by way of an answer is that imagining what happens to these people and how they think and what their fate is, there has to be a personal kind of mirror operating there. And the ideas that you attribute to these people, or that you find in these people. I mean, writing fiction is a form of ventriloquism, isn't it? You're throwing words into other heads. But that's all I'll say about that.
You've been listening to an interview with E.L. Doctorow, whose latest novel is Homer and Langley. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.